Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Ellen Starowski. Starowski is a professor and graduate chair in the Department of Sport Management and Media at Ithaca College. She's been published in many journals, including the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, Quest, and the International Journal of Sport History. She's also made several appearances on ESPN, Outside the Lines, and ESPN Classic. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now tell us a bit about your background. You're obviously making a career out of sport, but were you an athlete yourself in your younger years?
Yes, I was. But it's so interesting that you ask that question today, because we're on the brink of celebrating the 35th anniversary of Title IX just this week. And at the time when I was an undergraduate, going through Ursinus College as a health and physical education major, I could never have imagined that the career that I have now is something that I would have been able to pursue. In 1977, I'm certainly dating myself for the audience, but in 1977, when I graduated from Ursinus, my idea of a great career, and it continues to be a great career, would be coaching at the high school level and teaching physical education. And that was something that I really, really wanted to do. But I had no idea that I was going to be able to work in an entire field called sport media, that there would be such a business investment in sport management to the tune of $400 billion in the United States. And so what I'm doing now is really an extension of where I started at as an athlete. But over time, things have changed so much, and I've been able to benefit from that and actually turn it into a career, just as you said.
Uh-huh. And how do you think Title IX has affected sports in general? Is it an entirely different world, one that people wouldn't even recognize prior to 30 years ago?
Yeah. I was getting an article done right before I came here, and some people have actually referred to Title IX as being the most impactful thing that actually came out of the women's movement, which is really an interesting way to think about things. Mm. But I think in a concrete way, it makes a lot of sense. We've gone from a circumstance of 16,000 high school girls participating in sport 16,000 at the college level to 180,000 today. We've gone from roughly 290,000 high school girls participating to 2.9 million. That's an enormous change over a 3.5 decade span of time. Mm-hmm. At the same time, what we also have is an incredible change in societal thinking about female athletes, because the question used to be, should women participate in sport? Today, we don't even think of that question, and athletes who are competing now even find that sort of quaint and laughable.
it is.
You know,
women were thought of as too delicate. Remember the days? And then they couldn't play during certain times of the month. And,
absolutely. You and I do remember.
Destroy their womanhood. but there still aren't equal opportunities for women, let's face it, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we still do not see that many women, for instance, in coaching. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, you know, one of the grand ironies of all of this tremendous success has been the shortfall that's occurred with women in decision-making roles. And it's almost been an inverse reaction, where we've had more and more females competing on the playing field, and we've had fewer and fewer actually involved in the decision-making process and in literally calling the shots. So we've got a circumstance where about 25% to 30% of the entire coaching profession includes women now. And at one point in time, back in the 1970s, you would see a good 90% of all females being coached by women. So there's been this troubling trend of excluding more and more women from the decision-making process, even as they've gained more access to the playing field.
Hmm. Now, you wrote an article some time ago called Encouraging Women to Coach. Do you have to encourage women? Do they want to and they're not getting opportunities? Yeah. Or how does this work?
There are a number of different dynamics involved in this, which are really interesting. On one hand, we've got female athletes, because of the fact that they've been coached predominantly by men, even though they're participating on the playing field, they don't envision themselves as actually fulfilling those roles themselves.
Mm, that has to do with leadership, doesn't it?
It has to do with leadership. It also has to do with role modeling. It's sort of in tandem with that, though, is a complicated relationship between conceptions of coaching, leadership, and gender, because many, many female athletes actually do believe that females are not the best leaders when it comes to coaching. Mm. And so if you present them with options of either two candidates who have similar background and similar experiences, one of them male, one of them female, female athletes are going to believe that the male coach is actually the better of the two. And so we've got this very interesting gender dynamic going on. The third thing, which isn't all bad, that contributes to this, is the fact that as women have broken into more professions over the past 35 years, women do have far more options than they never had before. So from that standpoint, there's more competition in terms of ways that women can think about their professional careers. The fourth thing, though, which again brings us back to another problem, is the whole issue of trying to manage family and professional life. Mm. There have been some very good studies that have shown that women are really struggling trying to figure out how to have a coaching career while also meeting the demands of a family life. So there's no one answer that explains this, but it's a combination of all of the above. And the fifth answer, which also has to be taken into account, is the whole what's called the old boys network, where typically decision makers will go back to people who they trust more. In the athletic world, it's a patriarchy. You know, men are still calling the shots there. So they're more likely to pick a male coach.
Hmm. Now, how much do you think homophobia still plays in the yeah. realm of female athletics?
Yeah. You know, I don't think that we can ever underestimate how concerns about homophobia affect every person who is participating in the athletic system, as well as people who are not participating in the athletic system. Because one of the reasons why some girls will stay away is that they don't want to have to deal with being labeled a lesbian or with the complicated dynamics of sexuality. But homophobia is still a very difficult area for the athletic community to, number one, acknowledge, and then, number two, deal with. I have to say that there have been some very positive developments that have been emerging within the past couple of years, probably the most interesting one being that the National Collegiate Athletic Association actually held a think tank on these issues back in the fall of last year. And the fact that the National Collegiate Athletic Association did this, an organization that was really reticent about even mentioning the word lesbian, for them to have taken the initiative to create this think tank to bring in some of the best leaders working on these issues nationally to talk about how to advance an understanding of how the issue affects everybody in the athletic system within the NCAA is really quite a sign of change. And of course, implementation is going to have to follow from that. But this is a very, very good sign that at least the doors aren't completely closed in terms of talking about this and trying to come to terms with
it. At least people are acknowledging that it's a problem.
Yes.
Because you continue to hear about it, especially in the tennis world. I've heard about it.
Yeah.
People talking about certain tennis people, you know, mm-hmm. Oh gosh, it's quite disruptive, I would assume,
yeah.
even sometimes to people's careers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a longstanding problem of, well, we were talking earlier about coaches, but for a long time, if you can imagine, having to go through the process of sort of being, quote unquote, packaged a certain way just to get a job so mm-hmm. that there was even advice at one point in time that lesbians actually either have sort of a surrogate husband or someone who would create an aura of heterosexuality just to get through the interview process. So when you think about, talk about having to mask who you are, to suppress who you are in order to work in a system is pretty daunting.
Creative too. I mean, we all know what happened to Martina Navratilova. She lost a lot of money because
yes.
she came out of the closet.
Yeah.
And lost a lot of potential sponsorship and so on. Mm-hmm. And Billie Jean King did sort of hide behind a marriage at first, and that was eating her up. And
yes.
Yeah.
I'm
hoping and I'm happy that things have started to evolve, but I'm sure mm-hmm. it's still a major problem.
Yeah, and, you know, yeah. I'm thinking right now, I'm trying to see if I can create time to do some work really with undergraduate athletes on sexuality issues, writing about the ways that they experience that themselves on their individual teams. And of course, the problem of trying to get at that information is the whole taboo about coming out. At the same time, though, we do have a lot of athletes who are now coming out and trying to deal with the complicated dynamics, both on teams, with coaches, and with other classmates, is very, very challenging. But I think that sort of looking at these issues in a very nuanced way and understanding what's really happening with athletes on a day-to-day basis is something that we have to begin to address far better than what we've done up to this point.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about academic achievement in sports. I know that I've always thought that poorly achieving students academically who get slipped into different universities because they have these great sports prowess is a real disservice to them.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
Well, you know, there's a very interesting thing that's happening at the college level right now in terms of trying to determine whether or not college athletes receive what would be considered a legitimate education. For example, the NCAA points out that their athletes actually graduate at higher rates than the average undergraduate student. And so those kinds of data would suggest that athletes are actually better students. And to a large extent, there's a lot of information that would suggest that that's true, that athletes really don't conform to that quote-unquote dumb jock stereotype that we have, that they're very good with time management because they're so goal-oriented. They're going to be goal-oriented in all areas of their lives. And across the vast number of college athletes, that's probably true. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have this complicated dynamic of schools where there will be preferred faculty members who will change athlete grades. There will be bogus courses. There will be the practices of athletes not really going to class but having another student who is assigned to go for them.
Yes.
And also athletes being tracked into the quote-unquote easier classes. So the problem really comes in because of the fact that we know that there is some portion of those athletes out there that really are not getting an education. And then what are we really doing as institutions of higher education by engaging in sort of a wink and a nod and saying that that's okay?
But it is being addressed more so than it ever was.
I really believe that there are more efforts being made by more people at this point in time across the entire educational spectrum. Well, I would also say that there are other organizations that are also attempting to address this. Whether or not they're doing the right way or not, it's another matter. But the NBA, when they instituted their policy of not allowing high school players to go directly into the NBA and that they would have to wait for a year and a half to 2 years before they go. I spoke with some people who were representing athletes about this policy because I was inclined actually to say that that was a bad thing, that why not? If you can earn a high school degree and then go on into a profession, why not just go into that profession? And I was interested in their commentary because they were saying that the players themselves really felt like there was a false sense of security in terms of just going right from high school into the pros without the educational experience that really helps to shape you as a young person, and that the players really felt they needed to do that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ellen Starowski. She's a professor and graduate chair in the Department of Sport Management and Media at Ithaca College. Now, let's talk about the fact that you studied sports psychology. Well, what is that?
Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly enough, I have so many degrees. I started out in sports psychology, and then I moved on to sports sociology and sport management. And this may edify some people in the audience, but all of these are actually sub-disciplines. But sports psychology really focuses on the individual and their relationship with their own sport and their own life. And so it's designed to really optimize the human experience so that athletes will have coping strategies so that when they hit adverse situations, they're going to be able to manage their own internal stress in a way that's going to allow them to be more successful. It deals with the whole area of motivation, leadership, and human performance in general. In contrast, sports sociology really deals more with the really broad, big social issues, social change, a lot of the the social justice issues that we've been talking about, and the intersections between government, politics, education, nationhood, how all of those things converge to create sport experiences for individuals.
Wow, it encompasses almost everything you can think of in regard to human life.
Yeah, and that's probably the reason why I like it so much.
Yeah.
You know, my students often say, you know, after they've taken courses with me, that they had a certain expectation when they came into the course, and when they think about it, we were really just talking about life. And that's true. Ultimately, we do talk about sport, but that just engages us with everything else that's going on in the world.
Well, speaking of issues that are going on in the world, let's talk about the way Native Americans are portrayed in sports. That's one of the things that you've written about and spoken about. Lots of controversy about mascots and so on. Let's discuss that.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think this is really a testament to how teachers and students, how their lives really intersect and how the learning process evolves for both. Back in 1996, during the World Series, it was the politically incorrect World Series between Atlanta and the Cleveland ball club. And at that time, there were a lot of protests about the Braves and the Indians. And this certainly came out in my classroom. And at that time, I did not have an opinion on this issue. I hadn't done any research on it, didn't know a great deal about it. But my students were debating the issue and debating both sides. And at some point in time, one of my students raised his hand and he said, well, I don't know why we're debating this, because the Cleveland Indians are called the Cleveland Indians because of the first Native American to play in professional baseball, Louis Francis Sokolexis. I read that in Sports Illustrated. And that came right at the end of the class period. And I said to the class, I said, I think this is a time when we should find out more about this. And I promised them that I would call up the club, find out more about it. And then the next class, we would come in and we would look at what I had found. And interestingly enough, what I found was a very convoluted story that the club could not actually explain and could not verify. And thus began this lesson for me, because, first of all, they were making historical claims when they did not have factual information to back it up. So that was pretty interesting to me. And, of course, then the dilemma of coming back into the classroom to try to talk about it. And ultimately, that led to a whole line of research for me, where their claims are not as grounded, they're not as accurate as they profess. But that then became a troubling issue for me, because this was an introduction for me. I had no training in Native American issues whatsoever, which was also interesting, because then I started to think about that relative to my own schooling, wondering why it was that I had gone through so many years of school and yet really knew nothing about Native American issues. So over time, I've come to understand that when you scratch the surface of these issues, what you find is more than just an introductory course into racism, into genocide, into how the majority really controls members of a minority community in a profound way.
And how people perceive them
as
well.
Yes, absolutely. Because these images, the fact that we fight so strongly over Native American mascots, and you'll hear people say things like, well, I'm an Indian, I'm going to work to save this mascot, when in point of fact, they take no exception whatsoever to the misuse of the trust funds. They know nothing about the botched government misuse of trust funds over an entire century, and yet they will fight adamantly about a particular mascot, and yet they don't even know enough to know what's going on with those.
They don't know the history of what they're representing with
exactly
with this portrayal,
and so it is very, very problematic, and haunting, I think, in a lot of ways, because what you also have is members of the Native American community that will say that they want those images because those are essentially the only images or one of the few representations of Native Americans in the society. And so if you think about that for a minute, it really speaks to the complexity of this issue. But why what we should be doing is we should be aggressively educating all of our children to understand how we have come to this point in time, what white-Indian relations have been over time, and why we all bear responsibility for this. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's where we need to go rather than fighting about the images themselves. That would be my view on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you feel about all the accusations about doping in certain sports and how it is changing probably the landscape?
I don't study this issue. And
But you must have opinions.
I do. Of course we do. But, you know, I'm such a traditionalist, although, frankly, I mean, even that claim is laughable, given the history of doping. But, I like to think sort of along the lines of this Olympic ideal of just pure athleticism, you know, where just as human beings, we're just competing without the benefit of certain aids. Mm-hmm. And yet, over time, we know that people have been competing with experimenting with, you know, a wide range of things.
Oh, like herbs and almost anything can be considered impure,
yes,
in some way.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I mean, back in the day, you know, people would take shots and, you know, even
B12,
heroin and things like
shots,
that.
Too, yeah.
Yeah. I think the intriguing territory for me is whether or not the whole dispute about steroids is really where the questions really lie. And to some degree, I think probably not. I think we're well into genetic engineering at this point. And so to some degree, I think the focus on steroids probably is well after the fact. And what we're really talking about is genetic engineering, which creates...
Well, what do you mean by that? Just in general, or genetically engineering people to become athletes,
yes,
at birth? Or?
Yeah, so, in terms of essentially selecting your offspring, you know, if you want to engineer an infant so that they're going to be more likely to be a successful athlete, you know, all of the technology is leading in the direction of that potentially being the case. And certainly, I mean, it's no different than wanting to have intellectually superior children and trying to do what you can on that front. But I think that those kinds of things are things that are well within our ability to anticipate.
So you think that the controversy over doping is sort of a distraction?
Yeah,
the real issue.
Yeah, I really do.
Huh,
I do.
That's an opinion that I have not heard.
Yeah, well, that's the reason why I don't study it. Somebody might be out there saying, "Oh my Lord, is she a fool?" And they probably said that minutes ago. But this isn't to minimize the steroid issue, by the way. I mean, in terms of threats to health and the fact that we do have more high school students, both male and female, taking steroids. So I don't want to minimize the potential health risks of those things. But at the same time, I think there are some bigger issues that we're going to have to confront sooner rather than later on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about the ever-disappearing focus on physical education, mm-hmm, in school, especially the lower grades?
Yeah. You know, when I first started teaching my social aspects of sport course 15 years ago, because of the way that we're arranged at Ithaca, where we have these wonderful specializations, and we have a whole other department in health promotion and physical education, I intentionally stayed away from any discussions about physical education, and then over time, really started to rethink that, especially given the impact that the lack of weekly and daily physical education has had on the population overall. I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that as physical education has been removed from schools systematically, that has contributed, and certainly not the only factor, but it's certainly contributed to increasing levels of obesity over time. And we're now finding ourselves in a moment of societal correction, of having to really pressure companies in terms of dietary choices, realizing that our children are far too sedentary, that they're not getting out playing enough. The impact of not having genuine play and what that does to children's creativity and also their own identity and their own sense of confidence and awareness. So I actually have grave concerns about the lack of physical education in the United States. I'll say this, that physical education, I think, is also in the midst of a major revolution in a lot of ways, because professionals working in physical education have recognized the fact that they need to be doing business differently, that they need to be inclusionary in terms of all of their children, meeting the needs of all of their children in the classroom rather than just the elite athlete, which is part of the reason, I think, why physical education got removed, because there was a mindset that said, well, if someone was participating in athletics, then they they didn't have to have physical education.
Oh.
And in point of fact, every child needs physical education. The two are not the same.
Yet it also teaches kids about leadership and about how to get along and how to work
Absolutely.
Things out together in a group.
Absolutely.
It has more implications than just physical health.
Yes.
I think.
And across a range of student experience, so that if you have a disabled athlete in the class and mixed classes, male and female, you have, and across races as well, race and ethnicity, that you really encounter certain issues face-to-face in those environments that you may not find in a structured classroom that really need to be dealt with in one way or another. One of the most interesting lines of research that's been coming out in physical education that I've not been particularly supportive of are arguments of going back to what we used to have before, which was separate physical education classes for girls and boys.
I remember those
and
days.
The argument has been that the reason why we need to go back to that is that boys have been harassing girls and girls and boys should be separated. And I found that argument to be unpersuasive because I think it's exactly in those moments when we should be educating boys and girls about how to get along. And so I feel very uncomfortable with that logic of, well, I think we just need to separate them. I'm not really sure that that's...
But there is an argument a lot of women talk about in women's colleges,
yes.
where they can flourish. They don't feel the pressure or the sexism
mm-hmm.
or the self-consciousness that they have when there are men around.
Yeah.
So that's the other side of the argument that I can sort of understand.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up because having worked at William Smith at one point in time, I do see a lot of value in that argument. At the same time, especially having spent so much time working in the formal sport industry where women are outnumbered, I think creating ways for women to work in those male-dominated settings in a way where they can learn strategies for how to navigate is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some kind of a mid-ground would be beneficial. And also you need to keep in mind that most varsity athletic programs are sex segregated.
Yeah.
So girls really do get a lot of that.
Well, we only have about a minute left. I want to bring up the fact that on several occasions you've received a faculty appreciation award from students at IC.
I know.
What does that do to you?
Well, it generally brings me to tears.
That's a real tribute.
It touches my heart. Our students are just so appreciative. When they know that you generally have their interests at heart and that you really want to try to serve them in a way that's going to be in their best interest, they are so responsive and kind. And it's really been a very, very humbling experience to work with this group of students over time. I'm always interested to hear someone say, that this generation is overprivileged or, that they're slackers or whatever those labels might be. And I found them to be like college students forever, in all kinds of ways. But they've been extremely kind to me.
That's great. We have run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us, Ellen Starowski.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.